Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and this interview was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For the latest news and terms and conditions, go to ukwineshow.co.uk. Hi, my name's Chris Scott. I'm here with Doug Rigg from Le Cave de Perrin. How are you, Doug?
I'm really well, thanks.
Excellent. We're going to continue talking about natural wines this week. I'm going to look a wee bit about who produces the natural wines and some of the issues with sulfur and things like that. But before we get in, natural wine started out in France.
Yes.
And has it really grown? Is it spreading, or is there other areas that are into natural wines?
Yes. So France is the home, if you like, of natural wine. And the Loire is the home of the natural wine movement in France, with about 30-40% of the growers. I think there's probably about 250-300 growers who one might put under the umbrella, maybe more. It's very difficult to say, because some of them are very much under the radar. And some of them are incredibly famous, and some of them, you know, no one would know. Italy has its own sort of movement, which is relatively big, but being Italian, if I can say this, it's fractured and fractured and fractured again, because you get groups, and one group is a bit jealous of another group, or they think the other group is compromised on some aspect of something or other. So Italy, there is a movement, but it's a much looser thing, and it's divided into small little parts. Spain as well, same sort of thing. But in terms of the popularity of the market, that's a more interesting thing. Japan is the second biggest market after France, because they just love wines with no additives in them. In fact, they love the idea of purity is very, very important to the Japanese, and also wines which they also think the wines match their food really well.
Why? Because they've got funky flavors, or
because they haven't got anything in them? I mean, you know, in terms of they're clean wines, basically. So they really are absolutely adamant about low sulfur and no sulfur in their wines. And in fact, if they even measure the sulfur levels to see that, you know, the wines come in are low sulfur. And because shipping wines like this, they're quite fragile. And you can imagine if you ship them across a hot region, they would possibly re-ferment or spoil. The Japanese sort of are happy to pay for sort of big container ships which are cool, you know, which are the ideal way of shipping wines, you know, long distances. I mean, for us, obviously, it's not too much of a problem. We ship in the spring and, you know, it's cool enough. There's no danger of the wine. But once we get the wine, it has to be stored normally at a relatively low temperature. USA, particularly New York, San Francisco, there's a strong natural wine movement there. A lot of very good articulators.
Is US a production or a consumption-based?
Consumption, but a little bit of production as well. I mean, biodynamic movement is very strong in the US, but natural wine movement is strong because you've got some very good advocates, you know, people like Alice Faring and Eric Asimov, you know, who are influential writers and people read and like. So there's a lot of people writing about it in the USA, a lot of wine bars and restaurants that are sort of specializing in it. Australia is the other region which has really come in the last 3 or 4 years. I mean, virtually every natural wine you can get in this country, you can get in Australia, which is amazing. So there's 2 or 3 specialist importers. There's a wine bar scene in Sydney where there's like half a dozen maybe natural wine bars. There's all the top restaurants carry natural wines, and not only from France and Italy, but also Australia. And that's something which is really, there are natural wine growers in Australia, really of the last 3 or 4 years.
Which is a bit of a surprise, given that I remember a famous Frenchman went over and said, oh, Coca-Cola wines.
Yes.
So that is quite a change.
It's the counterculture. I mean, it's always about young people. It's a new generation of growers who you know, they start off working biodynamically, but actually they're not traditional growers. They're often artists, they're jazz musicians, and they look at wine, and they've traveled to Europe, and they've absorbed the culture, and they think, we could do something really interesting. And I think they're pushing the boundaries, even of natural wine itself, they're pushing the boundaries. So Australia, in a way, is like, there's a little counterculture thing which has come full circle and is almost leading in a way. And it's really thrilling, actually, to see people doing this, because they're taking so many risks that you wouldn't just associate with Australia, which you think of like Australia as being, you know, the big four corporations producing 90% of the wine, but there's hundreds of small growers, you know, with tiny, tiny little estates doing things by themselves. And we never hear of them in this country, but hopefully we'll be the company I work for will be introducing a lot of these like tiny growers, and people see that actually Australia is ahead of the game in a lot of respects.
What's the best places to get hold of Natural Wines in London and the UK?
You can see them. I mean, there's a few wine merchants who specialise in them. Le Cave de Prenne, who I work for, obviously. There's another company called Dynamic Vines. There's another company called Aubert and Mascoli. And then in terms of the high street, Whole Foods in South Kensington has an excellent selection of natural wines. Green and Blue, which is a wine bar in East Dulwich, run by a friend of mine, Kate Tull, has got a super selection as well. So there are some people who are totally passionate about what they do, and they are sort of sourcing the natural wines from the people who are shipping them to this country.
Do you find there's a problem with people going to a restaurant or whatever, getting a bottle of wine and then finding, oh, it's natural, and i.e. it's funky and it's not quite what they expected? I can imagine, you know, if you know you're, what you're ordering is a natural wine and therefore you've a bit of Russian roulette.
Yes.
Whereas a normal punter might be a bit surprised and even disappointed at the wine they get if they're not brought into it first.
Yeah, everything has come full circle. When we opened Terroir about 3 years ago.
What's Terroir?
Terroir is a natural wine bar in Charing Cross, and it's a partnership between ourselves and the chef, Ed Wilson, and Ollie Barker, who's the GM. And Terroir was the first natural, well, not the first natural wine bar in London, but there's one called Artisan and Vine in South London as well. And then after Terroir, we opened another one called Braun in Hackney. And we have plans to open other ones as well. And there's also another wine bar, which we're associated with, but it's owned by someone else, called Bar Batu in the city. So there are a few natural wine bars springing up. But Terroir, I remember being there on the very first day it opened, and the first three people came in and said, pint of lager, which we didn't do.
Pack of pork scratchings.
Yeah, more or less. And the next person walked in and said, looked at the wine list with total bemusement and said, where's the New Zealand Sauvignon? So the idea of a wine bar in those days was like, it was a Davies wine bar previously, where Terroir was that it was all branded. Everything was branded. You got beer, or you got like your New Zealand Sauvignon, your claret, your this, your that. So I thought, oh, this is going to be a hard sell. Anyway, having the courage of our convictions, we put together a list of 250 natural wines. Some of them were, you know, like nothing to scare anyone, you know, like, you know, and others were way out on the limb. And I don't expect people to sort of go for the cloudiest wines and enjoy them immediately. And we had a few sort of people would sort of raise their eyebrows and say, is it meant to taste like this? But how quickly people adapt. Given that Terroir probably gets, I don't know, upwards of 1,500 people through the doors every week, people aren't complaining about the wines at all. People are now relishing the wines. I see a Sancerre like this, this crazy Sancerre on someone's table. I think someone has ordered a Sancerre. They're not going to expect that. I mean, masters of wine and wine educators tell me that wine is not Sancerre. And yet these businessmen are drinking this Sancerre as if it's the most natural expression of Sancerre that they've ever tasted. So everyone has got used to the idea. They come into Terroir, it's natural wines, that's what they're going to get, and they like it. In fact, we're getting a sort of almost reaction if when we have wines, like, for example, we have a house wine, which isn't terribly natural, it's perfectly nice, and they don't like it because it doesn't have enough character. So I think people's palates mature, and also expectation plays a huge part. If I sell you the wine and say it's going to be, when I pour that wine, it's going to be yellow, you know, it's not going to be your classic sort of pale green Sancerre. It's going to be yellow. It's going to be, rather than gooseberries and elderflower, you're going to get ripe apples, pears and honey. Then people will fixate on that and they'll say, I understand it. When they taste it, then they taste it and they're fine and they go with it. So, the more we see in terms of exposure of these wines in restaurants, the better it gets. Now, we are running with our partners a natural wine fortnight in London, actually throughout the UK.
Is that with Isabelle Ligeron?
With Isabelle, that's right.
Yes. And we've had Isabelle on the show a few times.
Oh, right. Well, she's a great communicator. And of course, you know, she's a partner in the natural wine fair that we're sort of doing.
When's that? When's the fair?
The fair is Sunday the 15th, Monday the 16th, and Tuesday the 17th. Sunday the 15th is the is the consumer day, and then we have two trade days to follow.
And they're in London, are they?
It's in London's Borough Market.
Yep.
Yep. And but for the 2 week period sort of surrounding it, we're running a promotion in 120 restaurants across the country, where these restaurants will feature natural wines by the glass, most of them for the very first time. And they'll be from your local bar or gastropub up to Michelin 3-star restaurants. So we've really sort of said these wines are democratic, you know, drink them, make up your own mind. Some people have chosen exotic crazy wine, some people have chosen the sort of more, you know, easy drinking style. So I think it's a great introduction, and people will find the wines aren't, you know, ridiculously expensive or anything like that. And hopefully we'll in conjunction with the consumer day on the Sunday, hopefully we'll get some interest in the whole idea of natural wines.
By its nature, natural wines don't seem to be able to be the type of wines you'd ever get in the supermarkets, just because of volumes and also maybe consistency. Is that a fair comment? So would you say that these wines are more hand sale for upmarket boutiques?
For independents, independent wine merchants are happy to sell them, I think. They are a hand sell, yeah. And I wouldn't expect people to buy anything without tasting them. But so it's not like it's a brand on a shelf. It's a wine with a history, but you have to tell the history. And then you also have to let people taste it and make up their own mind. Not everyone's going to like the style of the wine, but I don't mind. I mean, I probably wouldn't have liked it 15 years ago myself. And so my palate has developed in a particular way. And these are the styles of wines I will only drink now because, you know, I've fed up with drinking confected, you know, sort of sweet mass-produced wine, you know, sort of. And when I do have it, when I do have to drink that other style or taste it, then I'm shocked how poor the wines are, you know, and how made up they are. And what I don't feel I'm tasting wine, and I'm really looking for the spirit of the wine and the truth of the wine and the purest of flavors. And
natural wines, because of the bottle variation and also quite large vintage variations and all that sort of stuff, I imagine you have to kiss a lot of frogs to find your knight in shining armor. Would that be a fair comment?
A few years ago, that was absolutely a fair comment. I mean, there was a lot of rubbish out there because I don't think people weren't making the wines particularly well as well. I don't think they knew what they were doing. So I think it's trial and error in the winery has led them to understand what they're doing. It's that understanding which is now making a lot better wine. I mean, 2 years ago, again, returning to the Sancerre, which is standing on the table here, this guy made a wine which just totally collapsed after 6 months. And now his wines, I think, have incredible longevity and interest, and they're 10 times as good. And if I can see that sort of increase in quality in a couple of years, then I think in 5 to 10 years' time, we're going to see hundreds more people, small producers, producing natural wine, because it's the way to go. And I've talked to producers in places like South Africa, Australia, New Zealand, and they want to go that way. They want to reduce the interventions and get to this style of wine. And they've never had the courage before, but now they've tasted the wines, they believe they can get there in time. So it's an evolutionary process.
Just on the interventions and the wines collapsing, I would have thought with lower sulfur levels, you would find the wines won't necessarily age particularly long period before they start to oxidize. Do you find that screw cap is more popular than, say, because screw caps, if you've got low sulfur levels,
yes,
screw caps keep the oxygen at bay better than a cork, but all the bottles you've got on your table are all natural corks, or they seem to be natural corks. So
yeah.
How long do the wines last while they're still good and evolving before they start to fall to bits?
It depends the purpose they're made for. So, and most of the reds, it's really paradoxical here. Most of the reds are made for early drinking because in France and Italy, you drink a wine for pleasure and you drink red. You don't drink white or rosé. I mean, you drink rosé, but you don't, the white production is not so important. It's a different thing entirely. So paradoxically, the reds are made for 1 year, basically, and they're to glug, and usually made in a Beaujolais-style carbonic maceration, be it from Beaujolais or be it from the Roussillon or the Loire. Now, whites, conversely, are made with skin contact and made in a way which is more likely to age. So the whites will paradoxically age 15, 20 years, some of them. So one has to always like flip around. And skin contact is the preservative. The wine is taking sort of preservatives out of the actual skin. This is a bit like tannin, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, and that acts as an agent to preserve the wine. The high acid levels also act as a means of preserving the wine. So actually the wines have the ability to age. One of the really funny things is that you can open up a bottle of what you think is quite a reductive natural wine, a white wine, leave it for 3 or 4 days, as it hasn't moved, it's absolutely solid, whereas most other wines will collapse and oxidize. They have like a level of something which protects the wine. But as I say, going back to the red wines, no, I would keep them in a chilled place, I would serve them chilled half the time, and I would drink them within a year, and then there's no point sort of leaving them any longer. They lose their purpose, because they're fundamentally, those wines are about fruit, whereas some of the other wines, they will age perfectly well.
And what's the preference, screwcap versus cork?
Well, screwcap hasn't really taken on in France. It has in the Languedoc and cheap wines for supermarkets and what have you.
I've seen Chablis and all sorts of stuff in screwcap now from France.
Yeah, I think it's more of a marketing thing. I mean, we've got a Muscadet, a biodynamic Muscadet, which is in the screwcap. But it's mainly cork, or it's that sort of plasticky thing as well. I mean, which I don't really like. I mean, I think if you're gonna make a nice expensive wine, use a nice expensive piece of cork, or go to screw cap myself. You know, obviously, I think screw cap would be probably quite appropriate for a lot of natural wines because of the low sulfur. So
yeah, exactly.
The trouble with screw cap and conventional wines is the high sulfites. You know. I think taint the wine sometimes, actually, and that's, to me, that's a wine fault. So you should be using less sulfur anyway when you're using a screw cap.
Mm-hmm. But it's not popular yet.
It's not really taken off.
Is that an ideological thing, though? Natural wine producers sort of on the verge of hippies. You know, they're all into this sort of stuff, whereas screw cap is a bit man-made.
I don't think so, because if they're happy to use plastic corks and things like that, then why wouldn't they use, you know, screw cap, basically? I mean, there are certain things, if you look, one of the bottles on our table, you've got a yellow capsule, that's actually wax.
Yep.
That's a traditional Jura closure, basically. So, you know,
it's not a Valjean, is it?
No, it's actually a Chardonnay, but so many Jura wines are still dipped in hot wax, you know, to seal them as an extra sort of, as an extra thing. Some people don't even bother to put the capsule on it. It's just a cork inside that. So I have to say I like good cork, and I like the fact that certain wines have the element to sort of, there's a bit of oxygen transfer. I don't mind that at all. I think that's actually quite a good thing. I haven't found cork taint to be a problem, except when cheap cork is used. And then, you know, cheap Altec cork should just be abolished. It's just wrong, you know, for wine. It's you know, it just affects the flavor so much. So, you know, I'm pretty relaxed about where they go. I think the people are fairly entrenched in whatever closure they've decided now, you know, what they're going to do. And I think the ones, they're probably going to stick to cork. Some people will go eventually to screw cap there.
Before we started the thing, you were talking about sulfur giving people headaches. Do you have any research on that? Because some people say, yeah, sulfur gives them a headache. Some people say no. Some people I've spoken to have said it depends on the person.
Oh, no, yes, absolutely. I mean, you'd have to do a lot of testing. I can only speak from personal levels that when I drink a wine which is very high in sulfur, I get a bad hangover, and that's after half a glass. And that's, you know, that's... It's not to do with the alcohol or the sort of, because hangovers are to do with obviously withdrawal symptoms and dehydration. Now I can drink a lot more of a sort of natural wine and not have the same effect. I mean, if I drank a huge amount of natural wine, it would have the same effect. But the massive, I mean, I'm talking about massive levels of sulfur in white wines, particularly like 240, 250 grams, is just like intolerable. I mean, you know, I can smell it, I can taste it, it makes my eyes water. It's not good for you. I mean, there's no doubt about it.
How do you taste it? What do you taste when you taste it?
You taste a sort of burnt match aroma, like you know, like the old sort of matches, which actually were sulfur matches, and it's acrid, burning smell, and you can taste it on your palate. I mean, but I think my palate is through not through drinking mainly non-sulfured wines, my palate has become more attuned to sulfur as a result. So I taste sulfur at low levels now, whereas I used to only taste it at high levels. And it's just about what you get accustomed to.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people drink wines and they don't know what they're tasting. They'll smell something smoky in the background. And for, you know, it is the smell of sulfur dioxide. In high proportions. The only way you can do it, actually, funnily enough, is if you taste things like dissolved in water, and you can taste sulfur in water at an incredibly low level, but in alcohol it has to be a higher level. But if you train yourself, you can detect it at 50, and you know we're talking about four times that amount. So it's I think if people drank more non-sulfured wines, they would understand sulfur better, funnily enough.
Okay, you said 250 grams.
Milligrams.
Oh, milligrams. Yeah, yep. I was going to say grams.
Milligrams per litre, sorry.
I was going to say, that makes the wine about a third sulfur.
No, it's grams per hectolitre or milligrams per litre. Because we use these interchangeably and sometimes it gets very confusing. It's milligrams per litre or grams per hectolitre.
Yeah, yes. No, that's right. Yeah. Cool. All right then, Doug, I think we'll wrap it up there. Thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome.